Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There have been more than 175,000 cases reported in the Northeast, including Quebec, in the last week. That's a 20% increase in week-over-week cases. Vermont itself has also seen an increase and reported 165 new cases of COVID-19 just today. Meanwhile, Group 1A vaccine distribution continues. About a quarter of all eligible people in that category have now gotten the first dose, according to state officials, including nearly all staff and residents in skilled nursing facilities, where the risk of adverse reactions or death is particularly high. But the state is still not vaccinating people at the speed it will need to in order to get the majority of the population vaccinated by the summer. Governor Scott, Human Services Secretary Mike Smith, and Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine all expressed confidence today that the state can pick up the pace, provided they get consistency from the federal government. As more Vermonters prepare for vaccination, there are questions arising about what kind of information should be revealed to those who've been participating in vaccine trials, primarily whether they should get word if they were not given the real vaccine so they can be vaccinated when they become eligible. In the AstraZeneca trial for a vaccine that has not yet been approved for use in the United States, some participants have been weighing whether or not they should leave the trial. VPR's Henry Epps spoke with Dr. Beth Kirkpatrick, one of the leaders of the trial in Vermont.
The volunteer, the subject, is the ultimate decider of whatever they want to do. So we don't prohibit them from doing anything. They can leave the trial, they can take the second vaccine, but it is really our job to sort of walk them through what we know that might help them make a decision that's, you know, in their best interest. So they're not prohibited from taking a second vaccine. We've had a few people decide to do that.
The full interview with Dr. Kirkpatrick about the AstraZeneca trial in Vermont is scheduled to air later this week on All Things Considered. You can also find it later this week at vpr.org. Today, though, we're going to look more at the vaccine distribution in the state of Vermont as we pick back up with our regular health update. And we are joined, as usual, by Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. Thanks for being here, Deputy Commissioner, and Happy New Year.
Hi, Happy New Year to you and to all the listeners.
Deputy Commissioner Dolan, let's just start briefly with some statistics and data that's coming out today. Vermont has hit 8,000 total cases of the virus that have been either reported or suspected. There's been a little bit of a change in how cases are being reported and how deaths are now being reported and recorded on the state's COVID dashboard. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a slight change in probable COVID death and probable cases. It hasn't had a significant impact on our overall numbers, but we are reporting those publicly.
I think one or two deaths were added to the dashboard that are likely attributed to COVID-19 now, but weren't confirmed cases at the time.
That's right. I think we added two deaths, and that's where COVID was listed as a contributing or probable cause. And then we have some additional cases that are added, a handful each day or every other day where it is suspected COVID. And so those are added in as well.
So about 8,000 cases overall, just 165. I mean, 165 just today, not just 165. I mean, that is a large number.
That's a big day.
Yeah. How would you contextualize it, given what we keep hearing about one day does not make a trend? However, we are seeing cases on the rise, and there's a lot of concern and unknowns about what may be appearing in the next week or two after holiday gatherings.
Yeah, a couple of things happened. One of the things that happened was that, generally testing went down in the whole region over the holidays. And so we've got more people probably coming out for testing. But the other, of course, big thing that happened was the holidays and Christmas and some gatherings there. And we are seeing that it appears that we have an uptick that is related in at least part to some social gatherings that happen over the Christmas period. And so those two things together are contributing to higher cases. And then, of course, just the higher case count across the country and in our region, which, of course, affects us when our neighbors' numbers are significantly higher as well.
So you're saying that today's rise of 165 cases, there are multiple factors, one of which could be that people didn't get tested right around the holidays and more of them are getting tested now. And so we may be seeing more cases that are sort of concentrated because of the uptick in people actually getting tested at the moment? That's just part of it?
Yeah, that's one factor. Another factor is likely the Christmas gathering. We are, our contact tracers and our investigators are seeing that some people are reporting that they were getting together with others, and that appears to be one source as well. And then just the general rise, you know, even prior to Christmas, we of course just saw higher numbers, and so those continue. And so we're not sure if this is a trend where we're going to continue to see now in the mid hundreds. It's challenging in a small state as well. Our numbers can be a little more volatile because of that, but we'll have to see.
So it's interesting then, because in the modeling forecast presented today by DFR Commissioner Mike Pichek, there was not one forecast for what the suspected cases might look like. And again, a forecast is not a guarantee. It's just a, you know, a prediction. And yet, given what you just said about rising cases and what the state is starting to understand about an increase in gatherings, which, by the way, were allowed in some limited cases over the holiday break, the state isn't projecting one trend line. The state is saying we could see continued flat growth of about 100 cases a day on average, or depending on what happens, we could see 200 cases a day, up to 200 cases a day in the next couple of weeks. But I mean, we never know what's going to happen. So why not predict one or the other in a forecast?
Actually, most of our forecasts have multiple trend lines because we don't know. And so we say, if we continue in this way, this is what it's going to look like. If we continue in what looks like a regional pattern, it may look like this. I mean, you know, we do it based on the best numbers that we've got. But of course, it's really hard to have a crystal ball. It does help us.
But they have had one prediction lately. There were times where it was like, here's the range of possibilities. But lately, there's been one prediction, and there wasn't today. I mean, it's not like a, I gotcha. But, you know, it was striking to see that difference.
Yeah, we have multiple predictions when we think that there's a surge coming or when we connect it to post-holiday. So anytime when nationally a surge has been predicted, then you will see multiple trend lines in Vermont, because we have recognized that there are times in Vermont when we're not following the national trend, mm-hmm. but we may. So sometimes what you'll see is multiple trend lines when we anticipate a change is coming in the country that may or may not be reflected here.
Got it. We have some calls, and I want to get to them right away, but let me just clarify the updated guidelines before we do, so that everybody knows exactly what the guidelines from the state, what the state directive says. Over the holiday break, I think from the 23rd of December through the 2nd of January, Governor Phil Scott had lifted the restrictions on household gatherings to allow families to gather with one other household over the whole entire course of that time period, not multiple households at individual times, but one other household. That ended after the second. So are we back now in the state directive that nobody is allowed to gather outside of their household except for certain limited essential purposes like childcare so that you can go to work?
Yeah, we're back to the executive order. The pause has expired. So the governor may have more to say about that in the coming days. But at this time, we are back to the executive order as it was. And the pause has expired.
What about outdoor activities? Are we back to one person may go for a walk with one other person? Or are families allowed to let their children sled with the household of another family? Sled or slide? This was a big problem on our last
one. Yes, it was.
Sled or slide?
That's a great question. I believe the focus really is on the social gatherings. We continue to be most concerned about that. I don't know that the governor spoke to the other aspects today, Mm-mm. but I know the focus really has been primarily on these indoor social gatherings. And so that's really where our focus is, especially now that we know that there is, you know, a new strain of the virus that is much more transmissible. We're really trying to focus on spacing, and uncrowded areas and masking. And so that's really our focus. And so so I believe that the governor really wants to continue to, you know, stress the importance of being aware of social gatherings. And so all I can say right now is that the executive order continues to stand and that pause did expire on January 2nd.
And we're going to get more into that a more virulent strain. And it has been found now in Saratoga, New York, and Dr. Mark Levine, the health commissioner, said today he fully expects to see it in Vermont at some point. So we will talk more about that. But Deputy Commissioner Dolan, one other thing that the health department wants to stress is that anybody who did gather outside of their household following the rules or not following the rules, if you had larger gatherings or even a small gathering, you are advising all Vermonters to get tested this week. Is that right?
Yes. If you gathered with others, please get tested. And again, when someone calls you from the health department, there is no judgment. It's purely an objective fact-finding mission to understand. So please go ahead and get tested and let us work with you. Our goal really is to contain, to minimize the number of cases. And one really important containment strategy is testing so that we can contact trace and advise on quarantine or isolation.
One clarification. In the state sites, if you look at the state health department website, you can find a place to get tested. It will tell you where the sites are around the state, and all of those are free. The state will ask you about health insurance information, but if you do not have health insurance, there will be no fee for you. Does that extend to pharmacies? If you look on pharmacy websites, they say you may have to pay or you may not. You need to check your health insurance and any state guidelines. But you can sort of go around in circles trying to find a direct answer to that.
That's a great question. And there isn't one consistent answer. So for example, if you have insurance, your insurance in most cases covers all the costs, but not always. You may have an insurance provider that pays for a portion of the cost. Usually a large portion if it pays for a portion, but not always. So we can't guarantee that. So we recommend that you call the pharmacy first and get that information so that you're aware when you go in what the cost will be. Again, in most cases, your insurance is taken and the insurance does cover the entire amount and there is no out-of-pocket, but that's not in all cases.
So the pharmacy should be able to guide you on whether your insurance covers it or not?
Yes, if you call, I believe Kidney Drugs is one, Walgreens is another. If you talk there, they should be able to work with you and guide you, either instruct you to call your insurance or they may know and be familiar with the insurance company. But you need to work with the pharmacy and the insurance company to find out for sure.
Let's go to Edie, who's calling in from Marlboro, Vermont. Hi, Edie. Nice to talk with you.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I just had a question. I'm over 75 and so had assumed I was in group 1B and might be offered the vaccine in February. But today the governor said, forget about 1B. And so it's left me not knowing what to do. And I have some friends who said that I should sign up and get on a waiting list or something.
So, Edie, let me just ask you two clarifying questions before we start, or maybe just one, if you don't mind. So do you mind telling us how old you are? You may have said it. I missed it.
Yes. No, I'm going to be 80 in a week.
Okay, so you're going to be 80. Now, so Deputy Commissioner Dolan, this is good. I'm glad Edie's asking this question because I think other Vermonters may have not heard all of the information and are now confused about, well, I thought there was 1B. I thought there were all these groups, and now they're not being called that. But there is age banding. So Edie will be taken into consideration based on her age, and happy early birthday, Edie, approaching 80, should be included in the first group, right, after 1A. So explain how this is going to work.
Sure, yeah. And first of all, I understand why it's confusing. It's been pretty fast moving. I mean, this whole vaccine development and getting it out to states has been very quick. And so what we're trying to do is adjust as we go using our own data and making the best decisions about how to prevent the most serious morbidity and mortality in Vermont. So 1A was clear. It was around those healthcare workers that are directly working with patients. And we have decided to shift the way we talk about the other groups as we figure it out. It's likely that we're going to be doing age banning. And with the age bans, we're going to be prioritizing those who are in the higher age groups. So was it Edie?
Mm-hmm.
Edie. So Edie is likely going to be in one of the first groups as we look at ages. And that's based on the data that we have here in Vermont that tells us that Edie is in a high-risk group by virtue of her age. We haven't figured it all out yet. In a few more days, they're going to be tightening up the definitions of those age groupings, also the definitions of which chronic illnesses will be prioritized for this next wave of vaccinations. So that should be coming out in a few days. But hang tight. Right now, it wouldn't be helpful for you to call your provider. We will have more clear guidelines on how you move into that, likely late January, early February, probably not anytime in the next few weeks, because we are still really working on healthcare providers and long-term care facilities right now.
Edie, does that all clear things up for you?
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, and good luck to you. And again, happy early birthday. Let's talk now with Mike Yantachka, who is a state representative from Charlotte and is on the line with us. Hi, Representative. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You may have answered the question I had in your previous from the previous caller, Edie. But I've gotten a few emails from teachers who are asking why they can't be prioritized since they're dealing with, you know, lots of kids in school and everything and are taking the risk of bringing a virus home. And I suppose that that would apply to any people that are in the, you know, public-facing type of occupation. And but by going to age banding, I guess what you're saying is that the age is going to take priority over everything after the first group of, you know, the group 1A is taken care of?
Age and certain chronic conditions, Deputy Commissioner?
Yes, it's likely, and again, this will be firmed up later in the week, probably through the governor's office, but we're looking primarily right now at age and chronic conditions as we roll out this next phase. Of course, the first phase with the healthcare workers and people in long-term care facilities, you've seen probably from our data that that was our very first priority. And now we looked more closely at our data and recognized that we had pretty high mortality rates among people who got COVID in some of the higher age ranges. We had pretty high mortality rates, and that really has to be our number one focus. In addition, we really want to look at morbidity where people become quite ill, and so our focus really is on those age groups, and those should be becoming more clear in the coming days, and on chronic conditions. However, I recognize that teachers do an incredibly important job in our community, and I understand their concerns, and so we will certainly be looking at all of the other important groups as time goes on, but our focus right now is healthcare workers and long-term care, and then moving past that, chronic conditions and age groupings. And we may end up capturing a lot of people through that work, and then as we move forward, we'll continue to look at the data and make the best decisions we can.
You know, I did get a tweet last week from someone who identified themselves as being in their 40s and said, you know, if I'm going to be ahead of a 30-year-old teacher, it's Kristen. She said, I'm 43, healthy, and work from home. I can avoid contact with others entirely if I need to. Why should I get a vaccine before a 30-year-old teacher? And I followed up with Kristen, and then Kristen said, yeah, I know, I understand the age banding, but I would, you know, get out of line, essentially, and let other people like this teacher take my place if I could, because I can avoid getting the virus better than somebody else might be able to. So, you know, how would you respond to those
people? That's a great question. We may not be moving the ages for every age grouping. So we're really looking at the age banding for those who are older. And then we'll be looking at other types of criteria as we move more broadly, but certainly it's those in the elderly category and those with chronic conditions. And again, no one's getting bumped. Everyone will be vaccinated. One of our other considerable limiting factors is the amount of vaccine we have. Unfortunately, it hasn't been highly predictable, and it's been less than what we were initially promised. And so with that allocation moving, recognizing that we have some limitations right now, we really do have to make some important priority decisions. But again, nobody will be bumped. We will be reaching everyone, including teachers, including other public-facing workers. We just need to work out how best to do that as we move through these important groups, really looking at the highest risk groups.
Wait, so this is the first time I've heard that there may be a change once you get to sort of a generally younger population. So are you saying that the state is looking primarily at age banding and chronic conditions now and wants to make sure it prioritizes people of higher age groups who have more risk population-wise, and those who have more risk based on their conditions, but that once we get into people who are in their 40s and 30s or at some age barrier, that the state may switch to a prioritization that takes into account someone's job?
Again, I don't want to get out ahead of those who are thinking through this. So we've got an advisory committee trying to think through the next phases. And so what I know is that the first focus is among age grouping with that elderly population. And after that, we're not sure yet how we will prioritize others. I think we need to look at the supply that we have and how quickly we're able to reach those who are at most risk. And that's all I can say right now about that until we've got more decisions made.
Let's go to Krista, who's calling in from Guilford. Hi, Krista. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my phone call. I'm a parent of a 12-year-old son who has Down syndrome, who has some complex medical issues. In our household, one parent works and one stays home with him as a caretaker. We worry about the future for him and how we will continue to keep him healthy and us healthy as caretakers. Where will we be able to find information regarding the plan for vaccination for families who are caretakers of children and adults with complex medical issues?
Thanks for that question. Deputy Commissioner?
Sure. We are in the process of continuing to develop plans beyond this first group, and then as we move to the age bands and the chronic conditions. And so our website will be the best place. HealthVermont.gov will be the best place for you to be checking to see what the plan is. We will do a lot of public communication. You may also hear through your primary care providers. We're still continuing to work out the details of how we will get the message out so that people know when it will be their time to have vaccination. And primary care providers, particularly if you've got a close relationship with your primary care provider and you have somebody, a child with special health needs, your primary care provider may also be a great source. Pharmacies will also be involved and they may also have messaging as well. So we're going to try to get messages out in many, many different venues so that people are able to get what they need. But that message is not available yet. So I can understand people's questions and we just don't have the information yet.
Is there a consideration for moving people who may be otherwise younger and healthier up into a higher band if they care for someone like Krista's son, who's a 12-year-old, won't be eligible for the vaccine themselves? Is there a consideration of prioritizing those caregivers in the vaccination schedule? I mean, is that even something that's being discussed?
I think the advisory committee is hearing from all kinds of groups and is considering all the different conditions and possibilities. And so, that's probably all I can speak to right now. We recognize that there are people who have concerns when they're caretaking either for children in their home or for other people in their home, that it might make sense for them to want to get vaccinated early. I do want to say that once we're moving past healthcare providers, once we're moving past elderly or people with significant chronic conditions, the differences in the timing of the vaccination might be literally a matter of a couple of weeks. Hopefully, if we have a good enough vaccine supply, we will have we hope to have a lot of opportunities for Vermonters to get vaccinated. So the difference between you and your neighbor getting vaccinated, assuming you're not in an elderly category, assuming you don't have a significant chronic condition that will be identified later, or assuming you're not a healthcare worker, that difference could literally be 7 or even 14 days. So we're not looking necessarily at months difference between groups, but I can understand people's concern because we don't have all the information out there yet.
Is this still complicated as well by the fact that there's a lack of understanding of whether someone who is vaccinated could still transmit the virus, which would certainly complicate the value of caretakers being vaccinated, but a vulnerable person not being vaccinated?
You know, that has not come into our decision making. So whether or not and how much somebody can transmit the illness or the virus, that doesn't come into the decision making around the prioritization and the rollout.
But not specific to, you know, the state's determination of who gets what when, but just in terms of actual protection. I mean, we keep hearing that we don't yet know all of the details of whether someone who's vaccinated could still transmit the virus even if they don't get sick themselves. So, I mean, that would just complicate things for families.
Sure. I think it's pretty consistent for everyone, though. That same issue would be the issue for anyone, right? So after the first dose, it takes 7 to 10 days to get some protection. But overall, we will continue to ask people to wear masks in space until we hit that herd immunity place. And we will learn more about whether or not somebody can transmit. I believe that the hope is that the transmission capability of this virus once you're vaccinated is, you know, much lower, but all those questions haven't been answered. So does it complicate it? I guess so, except that it's consistent for everyone. Mm. And so it's not unique to a family that's providing care.
Let's go to Emily in Rutland. Hi, Emily. Go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Emily. I live in Rutland, Vermont, and I am a cancer patient. I'm disabled and I live in HUD housing, and I've also got veterans in my family, people in the military. So my question is kind of two or threefold. It's, you know, what is the protocol? What advice do you have for people that are cancer patients, no matter what their age, or veterans as far as getting the vaccine and ways that they can go about that safely? But also in my HUD housing apartment building, there are over 70 apartments, one elevator, and I also have PTSD. So I was extremely triggered with my PTSD because of the unsafe and chaotic way that a vaccine clinic was set up. And I was one of the first people there. And I guess the last part of my question is mostly, you know, what is your advice to people who are in HUD housing, who are disabled, and maybe they see something that doesn't look safe as far as the pandemic about a vaccine clinic that's set up in their building? Exactly what are they supposed to do? And then if they do something about it and make a phone call, you know, are they supposed to be obligated to put up with verbal abuse from the people running the clinic?
So, Emily, can I just ask you, is this is a theoretical concern that you have based on what you've experienced before, or are you talking about testing clinics, not vaccine clinics, but testing clinics?
No, I'm talking about the vaccine clinic.
Okay, so sort of a theoretical, but based on your lived experience in HUD housing and from what you've had to deal with, what would...
Yeah, I know I'm not the only cancer patient in Vermont. I'm not the only person with veterans in my family, and I care about them and their welfare. How is the whatever the word you're using, I can't remember. How is the protocol going for what section of people is vaccinated first, and then next, and then next? How's that working for the veterans?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a couple separate questions, Emily, and I think we can quickly take care of the question about how veterans are being prioritized, because when we talked about this before, Deputy Commissioner, you said that it was being done through the VA for veterans who get their health care through the VA. That's a separately administered program. Is that still consistent?
Yeah, as far as we know, the Veterans Affairs Administration is handling vaccinations for their group, and I'll let you know if that changes, but that was our best information a week ago as well.
Okay, and then Emily had other concerns, you know, about her own experience and worries about the possibility of how it will be rolled out to her and others like her in her situation.
Yeah, and I understand those concerns. I think it's... really tempting and easy to start thinking about yourself in categories. So I'm this age and I'm in this category and I have cancer, so I have a chronic condition and I have some other issues that that would categorize me in the disabled category. And so I think, and then hearing suddenly, or maybe not so suddenly, but over the last couple of weeks, that some of those categories may not be rolling out in the way you thought, I can understand how that might be jarring for Emily. And so what I can say is, in terms of safety of the clinics, we do have safety standards and protocols, and whomever is delivering the clinics, so some of them, you know, the vaccines may be delivered by your primary care provider. And of course, there are safety protocols within that environment. Some of them may be delivered by Department of Health staff. Others may be delivered by other organizations. But we have standard safety requirements, and the vaccine program monitors the quality of vaccines and vaccine administration. So I wouldn't be too concerned around safety. But I think the other concern is, when is it going to be my turn? How will I know? What if I miss it? And that's where we have to ask Vermonters to be a little bit patient. We are very close to getting to the place where we're going to be able to describe more clearly when it will be your turn and how that will work. And you will hear that through the radio. You'll hear that through the internet. You know, we'll have a lot of different avenues to get that information out. So I understand that it's upsetting, especially if you've been very concerned about COVID and you're finally excited there's a vaccine. It's tricky to hear all about it and recognize that you might not get it for a couple of months. And so hold tight, and you'll hopefully hear in a variety of ways, including possibly through your primary care provider if you have a significant chronic condition.
Before we leave the question of vaccines, which I know has dominated a lot of our conversation today, and I do want to get to other things, I want to talk about what the state has said is one of its priorities, and that is making sure that Vermonters of color get prioritization in the vaccine schedule, because as has been shown around the country and elsewhere, people of color are at higher risk of getting the vaccine. They are getting the virus. They are getting the virus at higher rates. And in Vermont, that is very true. Vermonters of color are getting the virus at a significantly higher rate than white Vermonters. And the state has said it does want to prioritize people of color as it rolls out the vaccine, but has not been clear on how. And so I had a Twitter exchange during the press conference. Paivon said, if Vermonters of color are being disproportionately affected, why are they not being disproportionately protected? And I responded to Paivon saying, in part, it sounds like one of the things the state would be considering is prioritizing people of color within each age band, because that is sort of what it sounded like Dr. Levine was suggesting. But there have been no firm details yet. And Jessamine chimed in on Twitter to say, yeah, it would have been really nice if they had thought that part through. I understand people are stressed and taxed, but the fact that we can all see a path, prioritize people of color within the age bands, and yet the state didn't have it ready, indicates a deprioritization of this part of the mission. And Paivon also said, prioritizing doesn't actually explain how they will fulfill this, like translators, transportation, follow-up, culturally competent doctors. So what can you say on this topic, Deputy Commissioner?
Sure. And first of all, you're correct. People of color nationally and here in Vermont, for example, are infected with COVID-19 at least three times the rate of other Vermonters. And so it is a significant disproportionate hit on people of color. We are working with the communities, getting their ideas. We're listening. We are partnering to see what makes sense for the community and how they would like to be prioritized. Some people may not want to be called out and pushed to a front of a line, and so that might not be the most appropriate way. Some ways that might be more appropriate is getting more information to certain groups to make sure that we overcome any vaccine hesitancy or trust issues around the vaccine. If that's an obstacle, that might be something that's really important, making sure that we have the translation interpretation for the education even prior to the vaccination so that we ensure we get significant uptake in a very priority, high priority population. Other things we're looking at are transportation. If there are transportation needs or obstacles, how do we take advantage of the resources around us to make sure that people can get vaccinated and get transported? Other things that we've done in the past around clinics when we're trying to get to a community where we know there are people living there who really need it and who might be less likely to access it. We may locate some vaccination clinics physically closer to those populations, knowing that that will then increase uptake as well. So we're working with the community, and it won't be one way. It might be a variety of ways. It might include kind of a community health worker approach as well. So we're looking at a variety of ways to do this and working with communities. And again, people of color are not one monolith. There might be different approaches for different subgroups also within Vermont, within our vulnerable communities, including people of color. So we are working with and we are hoping that we have a strategy that includes a variety of approaches that works for people.
Let's go to Doug calling in from Barrie. Hey, Doug, go right ahead.
Yes, my question's in reference to the new variant that's being found in this country.
Mm-hmm.
My question is this an indication that the virus itself is mutating by itself?
Thanks for the question, Doug. What do you know, Deputy Commissioner?
Sure. We do know historically that this virus has a slow mutation progression, and that was one good sign with vaccine development, that it was mutating slowly. This new strain does appear to be much more transmissible. However, from what we know of this strain and what we know of our vaccine, we think that the vaccine has enough range to be able to still be effective against this strain. And it's likely this strain, because it's more transmissible, will become more dominant as well over time.
And this is not the only the second strain of the virus. There have been other strains as well.
There have been. This one is getting some attention now because it is behaving a little differently in a way that's concerning. So here in Vermont, we are sending samples to CDC on a regular basis, and they're doing surveillance in order to check and see when this mutation arrives here in Vermont. We anticipate it will come like it's arriving in other states. And so we are glad to hear that it appears that the vaccine will be effective. But what it really tells us is that we really have to stick to our mitigation policies around, masks on faces, on crowded spaces, and 6-foot spaces, because it's more transmissible. And so we really need to be thinking about that.
Why is it more transmissible? What is the actual mechanism that it is moving through that makes it more transmissible?
It's about the nature of the virus. There are more receptor sites on this mutation, and so it allows it to transmit more easily. And it's connected to the spike proteins, and I am not a microbiologist, so I can't give you more than that, but I can tell you that the receptor activity, the receptor capability is higher than in the strain that we currently have.
You mentioned that the state is sending samples to the CDC for testing to see if any of the samples sent are actually this new strain. Zoe tweeted, say, I'd love to know if any facility in Vermont has the ability to test for the new COVID variant, or do we have to rely on the random samples being sent to the CDC?
Oh, that's a great question. Actually, our lab just had a meeting about that today. And we are looking at our own capability, too, if we need to do that. But right now we're relying on the CDC.
And it sounded like the state is sending about 20 samples every couple of weeks to the CDC. So how likely is it that the variant would already be in Vermont and just not caught by one of those random small samples?
I can't speak to how likely, but none of us would be surprised, I can put it that way, if it's already here, given how the number of states that it's already in. And I believe it's in New York, and so that's in our region.
Yeah, Saratoga, I think, is where one the most recent closest case where it's been officially confirmed. So it does seem likely that it could already be here, right?
Yes, it could be here. Yes.
So we are also hearing now about a new strain that's been identified in South Africa, and there are some concerns that perhaps the vaccines that are being developed wouldn't be as effective against that strain. Is there concern in the health department and, I mean, certainly nationally as well, about the possibility of different strains of the virus that wouldn't respond in the same way to our vaccines?
I have to say that that's not a significant concern right now. Our biggest priority is to get this vaccine out. This vaccine is effective against the strain that is predominant in Vermont. It appears to be that it will be effective against this new strain that's moving through the U.S. And so that's the talk right now. I can't speak much to the South African strain, but I know that our biggest concern right now is getting the vaccine out. And we do know that it's highly effective against the strain we have right now, 95%, 90 to 95%.
We got a note from Thomas who says, as a retail pharmacist, I just want the public to know that we are very accessible to them. That being said, retail pharmacies are not being upstaffed. We therefore will have to get our usual work done. We all know how speedy it is to get your prescriptions filled. In addition to dealing with the phone calls, questions, and administration of the COVID vaccine, please plan ahead, be patient, and be understanding to our profession. We want to give everyone the best care possible, but in our profession, there is no room for any errors. So please don't argue with your pharmacist about where we believe you land and the priorities for getting the vaccine. We will schedule you as best we can. We are being educated on this process and do our best to keep up with the changing landscape. Deputy Commissioner, how is the state working with independent pharmacies and others who may be involved in this mass vaccination program as it moves forward?
Yeah, that was actually a great message from the pharmacist. So the pharmacies, there are two ways. One is that the pharmacies have a federal contract. Some pharmacies do, and they are the ones administering in the long-term care facilities. So those pharmacies are receiving vaccine allocations and working with people in long-term care facilities, both staff and residents. And so we're working with pharmacies. It's great to have that partnership. In addition, once we move more into community vaccination, retail pharmacies will be able to be another partner and play a role as well to get vaccines out. And so hopefully what we'll see is a lot of different ways. If you prefer to go to your primary care provider, that will be one way. If it makes sense for you to go to pharmacy, that'll be another way. We may even, you know, for some people who are homebound, we may be able to get the vaccine to their home. And then finally, community vaccination sites will also be available. So we're going to look at a variety of ways, and retail pharmacies will be one great partner in this.
Oh, another thing to mention, there have been questions about should the vaccine, the way it's being administered, change? Should there be a lower dose of the vaccine? Should there be only one shot given, but given to more people, and so delaying the second shot so more people can get at least some immunity? Or could there be a possibility, as has been floated in the UK, and I think will be admissible in certain circumstances, where someone could get the first dose of one vaccine by one company and a second dose of the other company's vaccine? What is the status of that in the United States, and what's the state's perspective?
Yeah, it's been really interesting to watch what's happening in the UK, and it's an interesting approach. However, in the United States, after reviewing that, the feds and Dr. Fauci and others in the administration have decided we want to continue with the path we're on. All the studies were done based on either the 3-week or the 4-week separation between the two doses. And those are the studies that show us the 95% effective rate. And so we really don't want to mess around with that too much, recognizing that I understand the UK, you know, might have a really good rationale for doing that. It's not a crazy idea. It's just not something that the United States is going to move forward with. There's a real desire to stick to what we know the science has proven so far.
And just to be clear, in the UK, it sounds like there have been some reports that this is going to be widespread practice. And my understanding of the official response is that it should only happen in very certain circumstances, sort of exceptional cases. Like, for example, if they think that somebody would not come back for another dose, or they don't have information on the first dose that the person has been given, not something that is going to be standard protocol there either.
Yeah, not standard protocol. I don't know how selective either. I think it's somewhere in the middle. And I don't know how much discretion. I don't know if that's all going to come from their national government or if there's going to be discretion. But here in the U.S., we won't be impacted by that decision. Our plan is to do the first one and then 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later do the second. Highly effective. And we're really excited about the protection it will provide. I know that people are anxious to get it. And again, one of the limiting factors is the slow trickle of the vaccine. We will eventually get enough. We're hoping that it picks up. And all we can do is ask people to be patient. And we are working through, based on our data, to get it to the people who need it most first, and then get it quickly to everyone else as well.
Let's go to Lynn in Marlborough. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi. This question may have been addressed a month or so ago by some of us talking on your show to the deputy commissioner, but we haven't quite heard back. I'm a contract tracer in the state of Massachusetts, and it's a huge project, but I'd much rather, as a semi-retired nurse, be helping with a delivery system here in Vermont, which I've been listening a lot to Dr. George's Benjamin talking about how poor the care delivery system is when we're in a society where you can have food ordered 24 hours a day and delivered to your door, but we're really having a hard time delivering the vaccine into the arm. So as a semi-retired nurse, we're trying to reach out and see how we could help give the inoculation, but the system doesn't seem ready for people who want to help.
Well, let me put that to Deputy Commissioner Dolan. Can people sign up to be administering the vaccine later on when we get this ramped up?
Absolutely. We're very excited. We are staffed up on contact tracing, but where we really need people is for vaccination. And so we have the Medical Reserve Corps, the MRC. If you go to the website, the MRC website for Vermont, you can sign up there. We've already sent out surveys to all the existing volunteers to ask what their availability is. And we're currently planning to bring them into our workforce, our vaccinating workforce. So that would be wonderful. Please go and sign up. and we will hopefully be in touch because we are definitely engaging our Medical Reserve Corps, and we really appreciate the assistance.
And we'll try to put that information up on our webpage as well. We've just got a little bit of time left, so I'm going to squeeze in another call or two if I can. Teresa is with us from Vergennes. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. My two main questions. I'm 7 months pregnant, and I also have severe asthma, so I know that kind of puts me in a more high-risk category, but pregnancy in general, we've had a hard time, even with OBGYNs, knowing really what the good protocol is because there hasn't been much information for the vaccine for pregnant women. But with that being said, I, you know, realize I might not get the vaccine right off, especially if we breastfeed. So with this new variant going around, is it just, I guess if I'm taking the precautions wearing masks and not being around people that are sick, is it likely that, you know, because it's more contagious that you're going to catch it in the community?
Teresa, I'm going to stop you because we're short on time. So two questions, one of which is about what's known about the indications for pregnant women getting the vaccine. And then, you know, what kind of precautions should Teresa, who's 7 months pregnant, take to make sure that she's staying safe?
Yeah, Teresa should take, you should take the same precautions that you would have a month ago, you know, which is since March, really, which is the masking, the spacing, really sticking to the folks in your household. If you are going to gather, it's outside and again, separated with a lot of space. So I would continue to go down that road, and we will know more about safety and if there are people who shouldn't be getting the vaccine, and that will become more clear in the coming weeks, and you'll be able to get that information also from your provider. But continue down this road. It sounds like you're doing all the right things, and I would really continue to that. And of course, you want to be vigilant at 7 months pregnant.
So far, there is no prohibition on people who are pregnant getting the vaccine, though there are health care providers, for example, who are getting administered the vaccine even while they're pregnant or breastfeeding, correct?
That is correct, yeah. And again, you would want to speak to your healthcare provider. There may be other issues, and I don't want to speak to, mm-hmm. you know, what Teresa's particular situation is.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Absolutely speak with your healthcare provider for any medical advice. Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan, Happy New Year. Thank you very much for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year to everybody.